Fortunately, Accepted's dresses did not have skirts divided for riding, and the necessity of pushing her skirts down, vainly trying to cover her legs, spoiled the dignity of the moment somewhat. It was the cold that concerned her, not modesty. Well, partly modesty. She noticed some of the guardsmen studying her stockinged legs, bare almost to the knee, and blushed furiously. Attempting to ignore the men, she looked for Swan. She had wanted to buy Swan a horse in celebration, too, and now she wished she had not let Swan talk her out of it. Swan could have used whatever practice she might then have had. She scrambled onto her mount, a stout gray gelding, so awkwardly that the placid-seeming animal twisted his head around to look at her in consternation. She nearly fell off, trying to get her other foot into the stirrup. That done, she gripped her reins so tightly that her dark gray gloves strained over her knuckles, her face set in a grim expression, as if prepared for an onerous test she might fail. For her, it was. Swan could ride. She was just very bad at it. Some of the men stared at her half-exposed legs, too, but she appeared not to notice. Of course, if she had, it would not have flustered her. According to her, working a fishing boat meant tying your skirts up and exhibiting your legs well above the knee. As soon as they were both mounted, a slim young under-lieutenant, his helmet marked by a short white plume, told off 8 guardsmen for the escort. He was quite pretty, really, behind the face bars of his helmet, but any tower guard knew better than to smile at Accepted, and he barely looked at her and Swan before turning away. Not that she wanted him to smile, or to smile back. She was no brainless novice, but she would have enjoyed looking at him a while longer. The leader of the escort was not pretty. A tall, grizzled bannerman with a permanent scowl, who curtly introduced himself in a deep, gravelly voice as Steeler, formed his soldiers in a loose ring around the pair of them, and turned his rangy roan gelding toward the sunset gate without another word. The guardsmen heeled their mounts after him, and Swan and she found themselves being herded along. Herded! She held on to calmness with an effort. It was good practice. Swan seemed not to think she needed any practice. "We're supposed to go to the West Bank," she called, glowering at Steeler's back. He did not answer. Thumping her heels against the gray's plump flanks, she pushed up beside the man, almost sliding out of her saddle in the process. "Did you hear me? We are to go to the West Bank." The bannerman sighed loudly and finally turned his head to look at Swan.
"I was told to take you to the West Bank."
He paused as if thinking of what title to use in addressing her. Guardsmen seldom had reason to speak to Accepted. Nothing occurred to him, apparently, because when he went on, it was without honorifics and in a firmer tone.
"Now, if one of you gets herself bruised, I'm going to hear about it. And I don't want to hear about it. So you stay inside the ring, hear? We'll go on now, or we'll stop right here until you do."
Clenching her jaw, Swan fell back beside Moiraine. With a quick glance to make sure none of the soldiers was close enough to overhear, Moiraine whispered, "You cannot think we will actually be the ones, Swan." She hoped for it, true, but this was real life, not a gleeman's tale. He might not even be born yet.
"As much chance us as anyone else," Swan muttered. "More, since we know what we're really looking for."
She had not stopped scowling at the bannerman.
"When I bond a warder, the first thing I'll make sure of is that he does what he's told."
"You are thinking of bonding Steeler?" Moiraine asked in an innocent voice. Swan's stare was such a blend of astonishment and horror that she nearly laughed. But Swan nearly fell off her horse again, too, and she could not laugh at that. Once past the iron-strapped sunset gate, with the gilded setting suns that gave it its name set high in the thick timbers, it quickly became apparent that they were angling southwest through the stone-paved streets toward the Allendare Gate. There were any number of water gates to the city where small boats could enter, and of course North Harbor and South Harbor for river ships, but only 6 bridge gates. The Allendare Gate was the most southerly of the 3 to the west, and not a good omen for coming near to Dragonmount, but Moiraine did not think Steeler would let himself be turned. "Live with what you cannot change," she told herself sourly. "Swan must be ready to chew nails." Swan was silently studying Steeler's back, though, not glaring any longer, but studying, the way she did with the puzzles she loved so much, the maddening, intricate sort, with pieces fitted together so it seemed they could never come apart. Only they always did come apart eventually, for Swan. The word puzzles, too, and the number puzzles. Swan saw patterns where no one else could. She was so absorbed with the Bannerman that she actually rode with some ease, if not skill. At least she did not seem ready to topple off at every other step. Perhaps she would figure out a way to turn him, but Moiraine gave herself over to enjoying the ride through the city. It was not as if even accepted were allowed outside the tower grounds every day, after all, and Tar Valon was the largest city, the grandest city in the known world, in the whole world, surely. The island was nearly 10 miles long, and except for public parks and private gardens, and the Ogier Grove, of course, the city covered every square foot of it. The streets they rode along were wide and long since cleared of snow, and all seemed full to overflowing with people, mostly afoot, though sedan chairs and closed litters wove through the crowd. In that press, walking was faster than riding, and only the proudest and most stubborn, a Tyran noblewoman, stiff-necked in a tall lace collar, with her entourage of servants and guards, a cluster of sober-eyed Kandori merchants with silver chains across their chests, several knots of brightly-coated Murandian dandies with curled mustaches, who should have been out in the fighting, were mounted. Or those with a long way to go, she amended, making another futile effort at covering her legs, and frowning at a tilt-eyed Saldaean, a tradesman or craftsman by his plain woolen coat, who was ogling them much too openly. Light. Men never seemed to understand or care when a woman wished to be looked at and when not. In any case, Steeler and his soldiers managed to clear a path ahead of them with their mere presence. No one wanted to impede the way of 8 armed and armored tower guards. It had to be that which opened the crush of people. She doubted that anyone in the crowd would know that a banded dress indicated an initiate of the White Tower. People who came to Tar Valon stayed clear of the tower, unless they had business there. Every country seemed to be represented in that crowd. The world comes to Tar Valon, so the saying went. Taraboner men from the far west, wearing veils that covered their faces to the eyes and were transparent enough to show their thick mustaches clearly, rubbed shoulders with sailors, leather-skinned and barefoot even in this cold, from the river ships that plied the Erinin. A borderman in plate and mail passed them, riding in the other direction, a stone-faced Shinaran with his crested helmet hanging from his saddle, and his head shaved except for a topknot. He was certainly a messenger headed for the tower, and Moiraine briefly considered stopping him. But he would not reveal his message to her, and she would have had to force her way through Steeler's guardsmen. Light! She hated not knowing. There were dark-clad Kyrianen, easy to pick out because they were shorter and paler than nearly everyone else. Altaran men in heavily embroidered coats, Altaran women clutching their cloaks, bright red or green or yellow, to shield what their low-cut dresses exposed to the icy air. Tyrans in broad-striped coats or lace-trimmed dresses, and plainly garbed Andorans who strode along as though they not only knew exactly where they were going, but intended to reach there as soon as possible. Andorans always focused on one matter at a time. They were stubborn people, overproud, and they lacked imagination. Half a dozen copper-skinned Damani women in fancifully worked cloaks, doubtless merchants, most Damani women seen abroad were, stood buying meat pies from a push-barrow, and nearby an Arafelan wearing a coat with red-slashed sleeves, his black hair dangling down his back in 2 braids decorated with silver bells, was waving his arms and arguing with a stolid Ilianer, who appeared more interested in wrapping his vividly striped cloak around his bulk. She even glimpsed a charcoal-skinned fellow who might have been one of the sea folk, though some Tyrans were as dark. His hands were hidden in his frayed cloak as he scuttled away in the throng, so she could not see whether they were tattooed. So many people made a din just by their normal talking, but wagons and carts added to it with the squeak of poorly greased axles, the clatter of hooves, and the grate of steel-rimmed wheels on the paving stones. The carters and wagon drivers shouted for people to give way, which they did reluctantly, and hawkers cried ribbons or needles or roasted nuts or a dozen things more from barrows and trays. Despite the cold, jugglers and tumblers were performing on some street corners. Men and women with caps laid out to collect coins were playing flute or pipes or harp, and shopkeepers standing in front of their shops called out the superiority of their goods over any others. Street cleaners with their brooms and shovels and barrows cleaned away what the horses left behind, and any other trash as well, shouting, "Make way for clean shoes! Make way if you want clean shoes!" It was so normal. No one appeared to notice the heavy smell of sour smoke that hung in the air. A battle outside Tarvalen could not alter what went on inside Tarvalen's walls. Perhaps even a war could not. But you could see as much in Cairhien, if not in quite the same numbers or quite as much variety. It was Tarvalen itself that made the city unlike any other. The white tower rose from the center of the city, a thick bone-white shaft climbing almost 100 spans into the sky and visible for miles. It was the first thing anyone approaching the city saw, long before they could make out the city itself. The heart of Aes Sedai power, that alone was sufficient to mark Tarvalen apart, but other smaller towers rose throughout the city. Not simply spires, but spirals and fluted towers, some close enough together to be linked by bridges 100 feet in the air or 200 or higher. Even the topless towers of Cairhien did not come close to matching them. Every square had its fountain or monument in the center, or a huge statue, some atop plinths as much as 50 paces tall, but the buildings themselves were grander than most monuments in other cities. Around the palatial homes of wealthy merchants and bankers with their domes and spires and colonnaded walks, crowded shops and inns, taverns and stables, apartment buildings and the homes of ordinary folk. Yet even they were ornamented with carvings and friezes fit for palaces. A fair number could have passed for palaces. Nearly all were ogier built, and ogier built for beauty. More wondrous still were the structures dotted through the city, half a dozen in sight on every street, where the ogier masons had been given a free hand. A 3-story banking house suggested a flight of golden marble birds taking wing, while the Kandori Merchants Guild Hall seemed to represent horses running in surf, or perhaps surf turning into horses, and a very large inn called the Blue Cat strongly resembled exactly that. A blue cat curled up to sleep. The great fish market, the largest in the city, seemed to be a school of huge fish, green and red and blue and striped. Other cities boasted of ogier-built buildings, but nothing like what Tarvalen possessed. Scaffolding surrounded one of the ogier-made structures, obscuring its form so that all she could make out was green and white stone, and the fact that it seemed all curves, and ogier stonemasons moved on the wooden platforms, some hoisting large pieces of white stone on a long wooden crane that stuck out over the street. Even ogier work needed mending now and then, and no human mason could duplicate their craft. They were not often seen, though. One of them was standing in the street, at the foot of the broad ladder leading up to the first platform, in a long, dark coat that flared out above his boot tops, with a thick roll of paper under one arm. Plans, no doubt. He could have been taken for human, if you squinted, and ignored the fact that his huge eyes were on a level with Moraine's as she drew abreast of him. That, and the long, tufted ears that stuck up through his hair, a nose nearly as wide as his face, and a mouth that all but cut that face in two. His eyebrows dangled onto his cheeks like mustaches. She offered him a formal bow from her saddle, and he returned it with equal gravity, stroking the narrow beard that hung down his chest. but his ears twitched, and she thought she saw a grin as he turned to begin climbing the ladder. Any Ogier who came to Tar Valon would know an accepted's dress when he saw one. Flushing, she glanced from the corner of her eye to see whether Swan had seen, but the other woman was still studying Steeler. She might not even have noticed the Ogier. Swan could become very engrossed in her puzzles, but to miss seeing an Ogier? Nearly an hour after leaving the tower, they reached the Allendare Gate, wide enough for 5 or 6 wagons abreast to pass uncrowded and flanked by tall towers with crenellated tops. There were towers all along the city's high white walls, thrusting out into the river, but none so tall or strong as the bridge towers. The huge bronze-strapped gates stood wide open, yet guardsmen atop the gate towers were keeping watch, ready to order them winched shut, and 2 dozen more at the side of the road, carrying halberds, kept an eye on the very few who passed by. She and Swan and their escort drew those eyes like iron filings to magnets, or rather, the banded dresses did. No one said anything about accepted leaving the city, though, which suggested that another party had gone out of this gate already. Unlike the bustling streets, the gate had no traffic. All who had wanted to seek the safety of Tar Valon's walls were long since inside, and despite the apparent normality inside the walls, no one seemed to think it safe to depart just yet. One of the guardsmen on the roadside, a wide-shouldered bannerman, nodded to Steeler, who nodded back without stopping. As their horses' hooves rang on the bridge, she felt her breath catch. The bridges themselves were marvels, constructed with the aid of the power, stone lacework arching nearly a mile to solid ground beyond the marshy riverbank, unsupported that whole way, and high enough at the center for the largest river ship to sail beneath. That was not what struck her, though. She was out of the city. The sisters impressed deeply on every novice that so much as setting foot on the bridges constituted an attempt to run away, which was the worst crime a novice could commit, short of murder. The same held true for accepted. They just did not need to be reminded. And she was out of the city, as free as if she already wore the shawl. She glanced at the soldiers around her. Well, nearly as free. At the highest point of the bridge, more than 50 paces above the river, Steeler abruptly drew rein. Was he mad enough to pause for the view of Dragon Mount rising in the distance, its broken peak emitting a ribbon of smoke? In her euphoria, she had forgotten the cold, but a strong breeze slicing down the Alandrella Aranin, slicing right through her cloak, reminded her quickly enough. The stench of charred wood seemed particularly strong on that wind. The trumpets had stopped, she realized. Somehow the silence seemed as ominous as their calling had been. Then she saw the cluster of horsemen at the foot of the bridge, 9 or 10 of them staring at the city walls. Why the trumpets had gone silent no longer seemed so worrisome. The riders' burnished breastplates and helmets shone like silver, and they all wore long white cloaks spread across their mounts' cruppers. Embracing the source filled her with life and joy, but more importantly at the moment it sharpened her sight. As she had suspected, a flaring golden sun was embroidered on the left breast of each of those cloaks. Children of the light. And they dared to block traffic on one of Tar Valon's bridges? Well, there was only her and Swan and the guardsmen, but the principle was the same. The fact that it was Swan and her and tower guards made it worse, in truth. That made it intolerable. "Bannerman Steeler," she said loudly. "White cloaks must not be allowed to think they can intimidate initiates of the tower, or tower guards. We ride forward." The fool man did not so much as glance around at her from his study of the white cloaks. Perhaps if she gave him a little rap on top of his head with a small flow of air. "Warain!" Swan's whisper was low, but managed a sharp edge. She looked at her friend in surprise. Swan wore a scowl. How had the other woman known? She had not begun to weave. Still, Swan was right. Some things were just not allowed. Guiltily, she released Sidar, and sighed as all of that joyous exultation drained away. Shivering, she pulled her cloak tighter, as if that would do any good. At last the white cloaks turned and rode back into the village. Allendare was a very large village, practically a town, with brick houses of two or even three stories roofed in blue tiles, where they showed through the snow, and its own inns and shops and markets. The blanket of white made it appear clean and peaceful. For long moments the white cloaks vanished. Only when they appeared in a gap between two buildings on a street heading north did Steeler heel his mount into motion. His gauntleted hand rested on his sword hilt, and his head swiveled constantly, searching the streets ahead as they rode down the final length of the bridge. Where there was one group of white cloaks, there might be another. Moiraine felt suddenly very grateful for the presence of Steeler and his men. A dagger would not be much use against a white cloak's arrow. None of her preparations were turning out to be very useful. When they reached the edge of the town, Swan again thumped her gray up beside the bannerman, still so wrapped up in her own thoughts that she rode with something approaching, not grace, certainly, but at least steadiness. Bannerman Steeler. Her tone combined firmness with civility, and a strong element of certainty. It was very much a voice of command. Steeler turned his head to her, blinking in surprise. "You know why we are here, of course," she went on and barely waited for his nod. "The women most likely to leave before hearing of the bounty are those in the camps most distant from the city. Visiting them yesterday would have entailed some danger, but the Armerlin has reports that the Aiel are retreating." Light. She sounded for all the world as though the Armerlin regularly shared reports with her. "The Armerlin has expressed her unwillingness to let any of these women slip away without receiving the bounty, Bannerman. So I strongly suggest that we follow the Armerlin's urging and begin with the more distant camps." Her gesture might have seemed vague to anyone other than Moiraine, but it just happened to point straight at Dragon Mount. "The Armerlin seat will wish it." Moiraine held her breath. Could Swan have found the key?
"There's not an Aiel this side of the Aranin, so I hear," Steeler replied in an agreeable voice.
The next moment he dashed her hopes.
"But I was told the camp's closest the river, so that's what it'll be. And I was told if anybody made a fuss, I was to take her right back to the tower. You're not making a fuss, are you?" "I thought not."
Reining her mount in to let Moiraine catch up, Swan fell in alongside Arrow. She was not scowling, but her stare at the bannerman's back was blue ice. The glow of Sidar abruptly surrounded her. "No, Swan," Moiraine said quietly. Swan frowned at her.
"I could just be trying to see further ahead, you know. In case there are more white cloaks."
Moiraine arched an eyebrow, and Swan blushed, the light around her vanishing. She had no right to look so surprised. After 6 years practically in one another's belt pouches, Moiraine knew at a glance when her friend was thinking of mischief. For someone as intelligent as she was, Swan was blind sometimes.
"I don't see how you can stand this," the taller woman muttered, half rising in her stirrups.
Moiraine had to put out a hand to keep her from toppling to the ground.
"If the camp is much further, I'll need a sister for healing."
"I have an ointment," Moiraine said, patting the scrip hanging from her saddle with a touch of satisfaction. The penknife and the dagger might be useless, but at least she had thought of the ointment.
"Now, if only you had a carriage in there,"
Swan grumbled, but Moiraine only smiled. Allendare lay empty and still. The village had been burned at least 3 times in the Trolloc Wars, once more near the end of the War of the Second Dragon, and twice during the 20-year siege of Tarvalen by Arthur Hawkwing's armies. And it seemed the inhabitants had expected the same again. Here a chair sat in the snow-covered street, there a table, a child's doll, a cookpot, all dropped by people hurrying to get inside the city with whatever they could take with them. Then again, every window appeared to be shuttered tightly, every door closed and no doubt locked. Whatever remained behind kept safe against the people's return. But the stink of burning was stronger here than on the bridge, and the only sounds were the creak of swinging inn signs and the dull clop of the horses' hooves on the paving stones beneath the snow. The place no longer seemed so pristine. It seemed dead. Moiraine felt a great relief when they left the village behind, even if they were riding south and away from Dragonmount. The countryside was supposed to be quiet, and the smell of burning faded the farther they went. Swan plainly was not relieved. From time to time she looked over her shoulder toward the great black peak of Dragonmount. Half the time she needed a steadying hand from Moiraine to keep her in her saddle, and more than once she ground her teeth audibly. They had often discussed what Aja they might join, and Moiraine had long since settled on the blue for herself, but she thought Swan might well end choosing green. The first camp they came to, 2 miles below Allendare, was a cookfire-dotted sprawl of wagons and carts and tents in every size and state of repair, mixed with rude shelters made of brush. Hammers rang on anvils at 3 different forges, and children ran shouting and playing in trampled, dirty snow, as though unaware that there had been a battle or that their fathers might be dead. Perhaps they were. It would be a mercy. The horse lines were nearly empty, and aside from the blacksmiths, few men were in evidence. But a long line of women, well above 50, stood in front of a canvas pavilion where an accepted was seated at a table with 4 tower guards arrayed behind her, so Steeler did not so much as slow down. Moiraine embraced the source briefly and felt Swan do the same. Just to better see who it was, of course. A multitude of thin Taraboner braids surrounded the distant accepted's face. Serene was perhaps the most beautiful woman in the accepted's quarters, except perhaps for Elid, though she seemed completely unconscious of it, which Elid definitely was not, but she had remarkably little tact for a shopkeeper's daughter. Her mother must have been glad to see Serene's sharp tongue go off to Tarvalin. "I hope it doesn't get her in hot water this time," Swan said softly, just as if she could read Moiraine's thoughts. But then they both knew Serene all too well. A friend, but a nettlesome one at times. Her saving grace was that she seemed as unaware of what she had said wrong as she was of her face. 100 paces later, the light around Swan vanished, and Moiraine released the power, too. A sister might see them, after all. The next camp, less than a mile farther south, was even longer and more disorderly and without anyone taking names. It was noisier as well, with 6 forges working and 2x as many children rushing about, shouting. The relative absence of men was the same, and the nearly bare horse lines. But surprisingly, a number of closed coaches dotted the camp. Moiraine winced when she heard the Mirandian accents as they rode in. Mirandians were a quarrelsome lot, prickly over points of honor no one else could see, always fighting duels. But when Steeler announced the purpose of their visit in a bellow that would have frightened a bull, no one wanted to quarrel in the least. In short order, 2 weedy young men in worn cloaks carried out a table and a pair of stools for Moiraine and Swan. They placed the table in the open, but 2 other youths brought 3-legged braziers that they set at either end of the table. This might not be too unpleasant after all. Chapter 5. The Human Heart. Once Moiraine was seated on one of the stools with her lap desk open on the table in front of her, she changed her mind about the unpleasantness. The warmth of the braziers dissipated rapidly in the open air, barely lessening the chill, and eddies of the thin gray smoke drifted into her face, stinging her eyes and sometimes making her cough. Stout shoes and extra stockings or not, her feet had grown quite cold on the ride. Resting on the trampled snow, they quickly became frigid. And what appeared to be close to 100 women, The greater number clutching infants formed a crowd around the table, all clamoring at once for their names to be taken first. Most wore plain thick woolens, but half a dozen or so were in silks, or at least ornately embroidered dresses of fine cut that indicated wealth or nobility or both. They shouted as loudly as anyone, though. Noblewomen, shouting along with the commoners. Mirandians had little sense of proper behavior. Helmet held on his hip, Steeler bellowed till his face turned dark for everyone to be quiet and form a line, and no one took any notice at all. Two of the guardsmen moved as if to begin pushing the women back, until a sharp motion from the bannerman halted them, and well that it did. That sort of thing could start a riot. Moraine stood up to try putting things to rights, though she was uncertain how. She had never had to face the like on any of her estates. She doubted any of her stewards had, for that matter, and people were more outspoken with a steward than with the lady of the estate. But Swan was ahead of her, climbing atop her stool with a scowl. She gripped the edges of her cloak as though to keep from shaking her fists. The light of Sidar enveloped her, and she wove air and fire. It was a simple weave, using tiny amounts of the power, but when she spoke, her voice boomed like thunder.
"Be quiet!"
It was simply a command, if impressively delivered, without anger, yet startled women shrank back, suddenly as hushed as stones. Even the ring of hammers on anvils ceased. The entire camp grew still, so that Moiraine could hear picketed horses stamping hooves. Steeler gave Swan a look of approbation. Bannermen approved of leather lungs in Moiraine's experience, and the women around the table a glare. A number of babies began crying shrilly, though, and when Swan went on, it was without the weave. Still in a loud, firm voice that carried, however.
"If you want to see a penny, you'll line up and keep yourselves orderly. The White Tower does not treat with mobs of unruly children. Behave as grown women, or you'll wish you had."
She nodded once for emphasis, then frowned at the mass of women to see whether they had taken her words in. They had. As she climbed down from the stool, the women rushed to form two lines in front of the table, with only a little elbowing and jostling that Moiraine could see. The more finely dressed women were at the front, of course, with serving women carrying their babes, yet they were not above trying to push ahead of one another and exchanging scowls. Maybe they were merchants, though what trade they could find here was beyond her. Once she had seen two well-dressed, seemingly dignified Mirandian merchants get into a fistfight in the street, bloodying noses and rolling in the gutter. Despite the petty scuffling, no one spoke a word, and those with crying children seemed to be making every effort to soothe them. A cluster of girls, perhaps 10 or 12 years old, gathered off to one side, huddling in their cloaks, pointing at her and Swan and whispering excitedly. She thought she heard Aes Sedai mentioned. Another young woman, 3 or 4 years older, about the age she had been when she came to Tar Valon, stood nearby pretending that she was not watching avidly. Many girls dreamed of becoming Aes Sedai. Few had the nerve to take the first step beyond dreaming. Tossing back her cloak on the right side, Moiraine uncapped her ink jar and picked up a pen. She kept her gloves on. The thin leather did not provide a great deal of protection against the chill, yet it was better than nothing. "Your name, my lady?" she said. The plump, smiling woman wore a high-necked green riding dress that was not of the best silk, but it was silk, as was her fur-lined blue cloak, embroidered in red and gold, and she wore a jeweled ring on every finger. Perhaps she was not a noble, even so, yet flattery cost nothing. "And your babes?"
"I am the Lady Mary d'Alhanna Conlin, a direct descendant of Caterina d'Catalana Corralla, the first queen of Murundi."
The plump woman's smile remained, but her voice was frosty with pride. It carried those lilting Murandian accents that made you think they must be peaceable people until you learned better. With one hand she pulled forward a stout woman in dark wool who had a heavy shawl wrapped around her head and a gurgling infant in her arms, swaddled so that only its face showed.
"This is my son, Cedrin. He was born just a week ago. I refused to stay behind when my husband rode to war, of course. I'll have the coins mounted in a frame, so Cedrin will always know he was honored by the White Tower. Moiraine forbore to mention that Cedrin would share that honor with hundreds of others, perhaps thousands, if the other camps were anything like this. Light! She had never expected so many women to have given birth. Keeping her face smooth, she studied the infant for an instant. She was not an innocent. She had observed horse breeding and helped at foaling. If you did not know how a thing was done, how could you know whether your servants did it properly? But she had no experience with babies. The child could have been 10 days old, or a month or two, for all of her. Steeler and his soldiers were keeping watch a short distance from the table against any further outbreaks, but they were no help here. At least, she could not bring herself to ask. If Lady Aconlin was lying, a full sister would have to sort it out. Moiraine glanced sideways. The woman in front of Swan was holding a larger child, but Swan was writing. Dipping her pen, she saw a woman walk past with an infant feeding at her breast. Half hidden in the woman's cloak, the child looked no larger than Cedrin, yet she was ignoring the line quite pointedly. "Why is that woman not in line? Is her babe too old?" Lady Aconlin's smile faded and her eyebrows rose. The temperature of her voice dropped. "I'm not accustomed to keeping track of every brat born in the camp." She pointed imperiously at the paper on the table. The ring on that finger mounted a large but visibly flawed fire drop. "Put down my name. I want to return to the warmth of my tent." "I will write your name and the other information we require just as soon as you tell me about that woman," Moiraine said, trying for that voice of command that Swan used. The attempt did not work very well. Mary Aconlin's brows knitted in a frown, and her lips bunched belligerently. She appeared on the point of bursting, or striking out. Before she could do either, the round-faced serving woman spoke up hurriedly, ducking in the semblance of a curtsy every few words.
"Kareem's girl is the same age as Lord Cedrin to the day, begging your pardon for speaking, my lady, begging your pardon, I stay. But the fellow Kareem wanted to marry, he run off thinking to become a warder, and she don't like who she did marry half so well."
She gave an emphatic shake of her head.
"Oh, she wants nothing from the White Tower, Kareem don't."
"Even so, she will receive the bounty," Moiraine said firmly. Tamra had said to get every name after all. She wondered whether Kareem's love had achieved his goal. Few men possessed the necessary skills. A warder did not simply use weapons. He was a weapon, and that was only the first requirement. "What is her full name and the child's?"
"She's Kareem Mowley, Aes Sedai, and her girl's Elia."
Wonder of wonders, Lady Aconlin appeared content to let her serving woman answer. Not only that, her scowl had vanished, and she was studying Moiraine warily. Perhaps a firm tone was all that was needed. That and being thought Aes Sedai. "From what town or village?" Moiraine asked, writing.
"And where exactly was your girl born?" she heard Swan saying.
Swan had doffed her gloves, a name day present from Moiraine to protect them from ink stains. The impatient silk-clad woman in front of her might have been a beauty if not for an unfortunate nose. She was also quite tall, nearly a hand taller than Swan.
"In a hay barn a mile west of here?"
"No, not the place you'd expect to give birth to your heir. Perhaps you shouldn't have been out riding so close to your term, not to mention the fighting that was going on. Now, do you know any woman who's had a child in the last 16 days and isn't here? What is her name? No back talk, my lady, just answer the question." The lady did, with no further complaint. But then Swan's manner allowed for no complaints or difficulties. She neither raised her voice nor spoke harshly. She was just obviously in charge. How did she do it? Whatever thoughts Moiraine had of adventure in hunting for the dragon reborn faded in short order, along with the thrill of being outside the city walls.
asking the same questions over and over and writing down the answers, carefully setting aside the filled pages to dry and starting anew on a fresh sheet, soon became boring drudgery. The only breaks in the routine were pauses to warm her hands over the brazier at her end of the table. An indescribable pleasure under the circumstances, with her fingers aching from the cold, yet hardly anything to thrill over. The only surprise was the number of women who were not Mirandian. Soldiers gone to war, it seemed, frequently acquired foreign-born wives. The anvils started up again after a time, and some fellows working on a wagon began hammering away as well, trying to force a new wheel into place. The clanging threatened to give her a headache. It was all quite miserable. She made a special effort not to take out her discontent on the women she spoke to, though a handful did try to give her cause. Some of the noblewomen had to be dissuaded from reciting their complete lineage back to Arthur Hawkwing's day and beyond, and a few of the plainly clad women wanted to argue against giving the father's name or telling where they came from, glowering suspiciously, as though this might be some sort of trick to bilk them of the coins. But it took no more than a level look to quell most. Not even Mirandians wanted to go too far with women they thought Aes Sedai, a notion that was spreading fast. It made the lines move a little more smoothly, if not in any way that could be called swift. Her eyes kept drifting to the women she saw walking by who were great with child. Some paused to look at the table as though thinking of their turn to stand in line. One of them might be the mother of the dragon reborn, at least if she chose to journey to Dragonmount to give birth for some reason. The only two infants born that day after Gitara's foretelling were girls, and like every other newborn, birthed within a mile of the camp. Some other accepted was going to find the boy child without knowing what she had found. She herself likely would not hear of it for years. Light, but it hardly seemed fair. She knew, and it meant nothing. Coming on to midday, Moiraine looked up to find a slim young woman in dark wool standing before her with a blanket-wrapped child in the crook of her arm.
"Susawin, Aes Sedai," the woman said meekly. "That's me. This is my Cyril," she added, stroking the boy's head.
Moiraine might have had no experience of babies, but she could tell a child of 6 or 7 months from a newborn. As she opened her mouth to tell the woman not to try her for a fool, Swan laid a hand briefly on her arm. That was all. Swan never stopped questioning the woman whose name she was writing, but it made Moiraine take another look. Susawin was not slim. She was near to gaunt, with deep shadows beneath her eyes and a lost, desperate look about her. Her dress and cloak were worn and much darned. Neatly darned, but in places there seemed to be more darning than original dress. "The father's name?" Moiraine asked, playing for time to decide. This child was too old by far, and that was that. Except
Jack, Aes Sedai. Jack Wynne.
Tears welled in the woman's sunken eyes.
"Jack died before the fighting even started. Slipped in the snow, and cracked his head on a stone. Hardly seems right to come all this way and die for slipping in the snow."
The baby began to cough, a chesty sound, and Susa bent over him anxiously. Moiraine was not certain whether it was the child's cough or the tears or a dead husband, but she entered the woman's particulars carefully. The tower could afford 100 gold crowns for a woman and child who might die without some sort of help. The child seemed plump enough, true, but Susa clearly was starving. And Mary A. Conlin intended to frame her coins. It was all she could do not to demand to know who Jack Wynne had served. Whoever it was should never have allowed matters to come to this state. Noble blood carried as many responsibilities as rights, more as she had been taught. On top of that, where were the woman's friends? Mirandians.
"The light bless you, Aes Sedai."
Susa tried to gulp back more tears and failed. She did not sob. The tears simply spilled down her cheeks.
"The light shine on you forever.
Yes, yes, Moraine said gently. Do you have a reader in this camp? No, Mirandians had another name for women who knew herbs and cures. What was it? Varen said I had lectured on the subject the first year she and Swan were accepted. A wisdom? A wise woman? At Susa's nod, she took her purse from her belt pouch and pressed a silver penny into the woman's free hand. Take your child to her. That brought still more weeping and more thanks, and an attempt to kiss her hand that she barely avoided. Light. Susa was not her liege woman. It was hardly decent. With the bounty to come, Swan whispered once Susa had finally gone, the wise woman would have given credit. She did not move her eyes from what she was writing in a precise hand, but what Moraine could see of her face expressed disapproval. Swan was very careful with the little money she had. Moraine sighed. Done was done. And then again when she realized that a flurry of whispers was rushing along the two lines of women. Word that one of the Aes Sedai had accepted Susa Wynn's child spread like wildfire in dry grass, and in no time she saw women hurrying to join the end of the line, at least one leading her child by the hand.
"My Donal, he's been real peaky lately, Aes Sedai," the round-faced woman in front of her said with a hopeful smile,
and a glint of avarice in her pale eyes. The infant cradled in her arms made happy burbling noises.
"I surely wish I could afford to see the wise woman."
The woman's grey woolen dress looked almost new. Moiraine's temper flared, and for once she made no effort to force it down.
"I could heal him," she replied coolly. "Of course he is very young. He might not survive. Very likely not."
At that age he certainly would not survive the rigors of healing, and besides, that was one of the few weaves that accepted were forbidden to make without a sister watching. A mistake with healing could harm more than the weaver. The woman did not know any of that, however, and when Moiraine stretched out a gloved hand, she jerked back, clutching the infant protectively, her eyes nearly coming out of her head with fright.
"No, Aes Sedai, thank you, but no, I'll scrape together the coin, I will."
Temper faded. It never lasted long, and for a moment Moiraine felt ashamed of herself. Only for a moment. The tower could afford to be generous, yet no one could be allowed to take Aes Sedai for fools. A good part of the tower's power came from the belief that sisters were the very opposite of fools in every way. Whispers again flashed down the lines, and the woman leading her child by the hand scurried away more quickly than she had come. At least that would not have to be dealt with. There would have been no way to avoid harsh words with someone who thought the tower could be gulled so easily.
"Well done," Swan murmured, her pen scratching away. "Very well done."
"Danel," Moiraine said, writing. "And your name?"
Her smile was for the compliment, but Danel's mother seemed to take it as a sign of forgiveness, offering her answers in a relieved voice. Moiraine was glad to hear it. Many people feared the White Tower, occasionally with reason. The tower could be stern when it must. But fear was a poor tool, and one that always cut the user eventually. She had learned that long before coming to the tower. Once the sun passed its zenith, Swan and she went to fetch the food from their saddlebags. There was certainly no point in asking one of Steeler's men to do it. They were already squatting on their heels, making a meal from dried meat and flatbread, not far from where their mounts were tethered on one of the horse lines. None looked ready to stir a foot, short of being attacked. But Steeler bowed his head to her and Swan as they turned from their mounts. Only the slightest bob, yet approving, she thought. Men were decidedly odd. With less than half the women's names recorded, she expected grumbling at least, but those remaining scattered to find their own food without a single complaint. A dark woman with a Tyran accent brought a battered tin teapot filled to the brim with hot dark tea to the table, and a pair of green mugs with cracked glazing, and a lean, gray-haired woman brought two steaming wooden tankards that gave off the scent of hot spiced wine. Her leathery face looked as though a smile had never touched it.
So Sawin's too proud to take more than a little food from anybody, except for her babe, she said, in a deep voice for a woman as she set the tankards down. What you did was kindly done, and well. With a nod, she turned and strode away across the snow, her back as straight as a guardsman on parade. That was certainly a peculiar manner with an Aes Sedai. She knows who we really are, Swan said softly, picking up the tankard in both hands to let the warmth soak in. Moiraine did the same, gloves or no. Poor Swan's fingers must have been freezing. She will not tell, Moiraine said after a moment, and Swan nodded. Not that the truth would cause any real problems, not with Steeler and his men present, but it was better to avoid the embarrassment. To think that one of the commoners would know an Aes Sedai's face when none of the noblewomen had. An Aes Sedai's face or an accepted's dress. Or both. She went to the tower when she was young, I think. A woman who could not be taught to channel was sent away, yet she would have seen Aes Sedai and accepted. Swan gave her a sideways look, as though she had said water was wet. Sometimes it could be irritating when Swan puzzled things out ahead of her. They spoke little while they ate their bread and fruit and cheese. Novices were expected to keep silent during meals, and accepted to maintain a measure of dignity, so they had grown accustomed to eating quietly. The wine they barely touched. Accepted had wine with meals, but watered, and it would never do for one of them to grow tipsy. Yet Moiraine was surprised to find that she had devoured every scrap of the meal she had been certain was too much. Perhaps being out in the cold had increased her appetite. She was folding up the cloths the food had been bundled in, and wishing there had been a few more of the dried apricots when Swan suddenly muttered, "Oh, no." Moiraine looked up, and her heart sank. Two sisters were riding into the camp, slowly picking their way between the tents and wagons. In the current state of affairs, women dressed in silk yet moving about the countryside without an entourage had to be sisters, and these were followed by just one man, a dark fellow in a cloak that shifted colors and blended with what lay behind him, so that parts of him and parts of his black gelding seemed not to be there at all. His eyes never rested long in one place. He made the tower guards seem half asleep lapdogs compared to a hunting leopard. A warder's cloak was a disconcerting sight, and murmurs rose in the camp, people gaping and pointing. The blacksmiths lowered their hammers in silence once more. It was not the appearance of just any sisters that made Moiraine's stomach feel hollow. She recognized the faces framed by the hoods of their cloaks. Malin Arganya, with her silver-gray hair and thrusting chin, was one of the most respected women in the tower. It was said that no one had a bad word for Malin. By herself, she would not have given Moiraine a moment's pause. The other, however, was Elida Arroyhan. Light, what was she doing here? Elida had become advisor to the Queen of Andor nearly 3 years ago. She did return to the tower for occasional visits, to confer with the Amyrlin on events in Andor, but Swan and Moiraine always learned of her arrival very quickly, to their regret. They offered curtsies as soon as the sisters came near, and Swan burst out with, "We have permission to be here." Even Malin might become upset if she began to berate them, only to learn she had no cause. Elida would be furious. She absolutely hated looking foolish. "The Amyrlin seat ordered us—" "We know about that," Malin cut in mildly. "The way word is spreading, I suspect the cats in Salizen know by now." From her tone, you could not say whether she agreed with Tamra's decision. Malin's smooth face never showed any hint of emotion. Her startling blue eyes held serenity as a cup held water. With a dark-gloved hand, she carefully adjusted one of her divided skirts, so slashed with white that it seemed white trimmed with blue. She was one of the relatively few whites to have a warder. Wrapped up in questions of rationality and philosophy, the greater number saw no need. Moiraine wished she would dismount. Malin's dappled gelding was tall, and she herself was as tall as most men. Most Kyrianan men, at least. Looking up at her in the saddle threatened to give Moiraine an ache in her neck.
"You are surprised to see me?" Elida said, looking down from her fine-ankled bay mare. Her brocaded dress was not a muted red or a faint red, but a bright hue, as though she were screaming her Aja to the world. Her cloak, lined with black fur, was exactly the same shade. A color fit for a tinker's wagon, Moiraine thought. Elida was smiling, yet that failed to lessen the severity of her face. She might have been beautiful except for that. Everything about her was severe. "I reached Tarvalen just before the Aiel, and I've been busy since. But never fear, I will call on both of you." Moiraine had been sure her heart could sink no further, but she had been mistaken. It was very hard not to groan in despair. Malin sighed. "You pay these girls too much mind, Elida. They'll get above themselves if they start thinking they're your pets. They may already." Moiraine exchanged shocked glances with Swan. Pets? Goats staked out for lions, perhaps, but never pets. Since gaining the shawl, Elida had never deferred to anyone other than the Ammerlin seat or a sitter that Moiraine had seen, yet she bowed her head and murmured, "As you say, Malin, but it seems possible they might test before the end of the year. I expect them to, and I expect them to pass easily. I'll accept nothing less from either." Even that lacked her usual intensity. Normally Elida seemed as stiff-necked as a bull. Normally she browbeat everyone who crossed her path. The White Sister gave a slight shrug, as though the matter was not important enough to say more. "Do you children have everything you need? Good. Some of you children came very poorly prepared, I must say. How many names do you have left to take here?"
"About 50, Malin said I," Swan told her. "Maybe a few more."
Malin glanced up at the sun, its fall toward the western horizon well begun. The dark clouds that threatened snow were moving south, leaving behind clear sky. "In that case, write quickly. You must be back in the tower before dark, you know."
"Are all the camps like this?" Moiraine asked. "I would think that men fighting a war would have their minds on that, not on..."
She trailed off, her face heating.
"Spawning like silver pike," Swan whispered under her breath.
Moiraine only just heard, but the words deepened her blush. Why ever had she asked such a question in the first place?
"Kyrianen," Malin breathed.
She sounded very nearly amused, but she went on in a serious tone.
"When a man believes he may die, he wants to leave something of himself behind. When a woman believes her man may die, she wants that part of him desperately. The result is a great many babies born during wars. It's illogical, given the hardship that comes if the man does die or the woman, but the human heart is seldom logical."
Which explained a great deal, and left Moiraine feeling that her face might burn off. There were things one did in public and talked about, and things that were done in private and definitely not talked about. She struggled to regain control of herself, performing mental exercises for seeking calm. She was the river contained by the bank. She was the bank containing the river. She was a flower bud opening to the sun. It did not help that Elida was studying her and Swan like a sculptor hefting hammer and chisel, deciding which piece of stone to remove next, in order to bring out the form she wanted.
"Yes, yes, Andro," Malin said suddenly. "We will go in a moment."
She had not even looked back at her warder, yet he nodded as though she had responded to something he had said. Lean and no taller than his Aes Sedai, he appeared youthful. Until you noticed his eyes. Moiraine found herself gaping, embarrassment forgotten, and not because of Andro's unblinking gaze. A sister and her bonded warder could sense each other's emotions and physical condition, and each knew exactly where the other was, if they were close enough, and at least a direction if they were far apart. But this seemed on the order of reading minds. Some said that full sisters could do that.
There were a number of things that you were not taught until you had attained the shawl, after all, such as the weave for bonding a warder. Malin looked straight into her eyes. No, she said softly. I can't read his thoughts. Moiraine's scalp prickled, as though her hair were trying to stand on end. It must be true, since Malin had said it, yet... When you've had a warder long enough, you will know what he is thinking, and he will know what you are. A matter of interpretation. Elida sniffed, though quietly. Alone among the Ajahs, the Red refused to bond warders. Most Reds seem to dislike men altogether. Logically, Malin said, her serene gaze going to the other sister, Reds have greater needs of warders than any except Greens. Some greater even than Greens. But no matter. The Ajahs choose as they will. She lifted her fringed reins. Are you coming, Elida? We must reach as many of the children as possible. Some are certain to lose their heads and remain too long without a reminder. Remember, children, before dark. Moiraine expected some sort of eruption from Elida, or at least a flash of anger in her eyes. That comment about warders came very close to violating the codes of courtesy and privacy that governed sisters' lives, all the rules of what an Aes Sedai could say to or ask of another and what not. They were not laws, but rather customs stronger than law, and every accepted had to memorize them. Surprisingly, Elida merely turned her bay to follow. Watching the two sisters leave the camp, trailed by Andro, Swan heaved a relieved sigh. I was afraid she'd stay to supervise us. Yes, Moiraine said. There was no need to say which woman Swan meant. It would have been right in Elida's character. Nothing they did could escape her demands for absolute perfection. But why did she not? Swan had no answer for that, and in any event, there was no time to discuss it. With Moiraine's and her meal clearly finished, the women had taken their places in line again, and after Malin and Elida's visit, they no longer seemed so certain that the two were Aes Sedai. A level look and a firm voice failed to squelch argument now. Swan took to shouting when necessary, which it frequently was, and running her hands through her hair in frustration. 3 times Moiraine had to threaten to cease taking down any names at all before a woman carrying a child that was obviously too old would leave the line. She might have been tempted had one of them resembled Susa, but they were well fed and plainly no poorer than anyone else, just greedy. To cap it off, with above 12 women still in front of the table, Steeler appeared, helmet on his head and leading his mount. The other soldiers were not far behind, 2 of them holding the reins of Arrow and Swan's animal.
Time to go, Steeler said in that gravelly voice. I left it as long as I could, but leave it any longer and we'll be hard-pressed to make the tower by sunset.
Here now, one of the women protested. They've got to take our names.
Angry mutters rose from the rest.